This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reapdress, a one-person business based in Philadelphia. Sophie started making leggings and expanded from there over the years. She's making cave suits now. She started caving, and she was looking for suits, and she didn't notice a whole lot to choose from. So she knew what she was doing, so she decided to start making her own. And she caves a lot, by the way. And these cave suits are made with 500 denier cordura and 1,000 denier cordura in places where you need a little reinforcement, elbows, knees, the rear end, you know where you need a little extra help. And she makes these in a lot of different colors. A lot of cave suits, you know, they'll come in one, two, three colors, whatever. She's got if you go to the website, sophiereapdress.com, you'll see all these colors to choose from. And you can have add-ons. These are custom suits. You tell her what you want, and she makes it for you. She doesn't have a huge stockpile or anything. She'll put on extra pockets. She'll put on inside pockets, knee pad pockets, bat stencils. The bat stencils are cool. And the website is sophiereapdress.com, and I'll link you to it in the description of this podcast. Sophie Reapdress for a custom cave suit that will last for a long time. SophieReapdress.com. Again, I'll link you in the description of this podcast. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm Matt Pelser, your host. I am a member of the Central Indiana Grotto, former chair. And okay, what is a grotto? It's a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, our national organization here in the United States. And why are we organized? Why do we make a fuss about being organized? Well, because caving is not like hiking. You can't just go and do it by yourself. And so it's kind of a different thing. And if you don't know what you're doing, it can be dangerous. But if you do, quite the opposite is true. And so all we ask is that if you're going to go caving, that you do it right and you do it with people who know what they're doing. And once you do that enough, you'll be the person who knows what you're doing. And you'll have made new friends by joining a grotto. I've got a link in the description of this podcast to find your local grotto or the grotto nearest you. And there are also some virtual grottos that have popped up. Out of Bounds Grotto being one of them. So if you're in an area where there's not a local grotto, so to speak, you can get in touch with them. So if you're going to do it the right way. Tag Fall Cave-In, big event happening next weekend, October 6th through the 9th. I wish I could say I could make it. I've had a couple of people ask me so far if I'm going to go. No, I can't. But I got a good excuse. I'm officiating a wedding that weekend up in Michigan. I've also been invited to go to the Texas Cavers reunion. Thank you to Crash for that invitation. I'm sorry to say I won't be able to make that either. It's a whole thing. But I am planning on going caving this month, a short kids trip. I'm going to take my kids and my cousin's kids down to Sullivan Cave. At least that's the plan. We'll see if it happens. And I am also, just a quick announcement, I'm going to get into this month's episode a little sooner than last month. Last month, the intro was really long. Sorry about that. But I do want to reiterate that I am going to be the keynote speaker at Carter Cave State Resort Park's Winter Adventure Weekend in late January. So I'll put a link in the description of this podcast to the website, which is winteradventureweekend.com. If you want to make it out there and maybe we can go caving together. And that's of course, in Kentucky at Carter Caves. Okay, so this is part two of my big talk with Marion Akers, and what a pleasure it was to have this time. And after we had this talk, she kind of reiterated to me just, you know, how nice it was to talk and how easy I made it on her. But let me just say this. She made it easy on me, too. It's a two-way street. There's nothing like talking to somebody who wants to talk. And she definitely was ready to talk. She was prepared. She had, you know, outlined all the things she wanted to talk about. And we didn't even get to all of them. And so we actually reconvened. You'll hear that later on in the episode where, you know, her audio will change and we kind of fill you in on a few more details of some of the things that she had talked about and some of the things she wanted to make sure she got out there. So you'll notice that. So wonderful to have this talk with Marion Akers. We get into a bunch of the Indiana stuff. We get into the rescue in 2016. Yeah, kind of a harrowing story. And I won't say anything more. So here we go. Part two of my talk with Marion Akers. So in between going to Mexico, I mean, you're doing an awful lot in Indiana. You're doing Binkley. You're working with Dave.
You're caving with Tim.
Yeah, yeah.
We missed Tim.
Yeah, yeah. And he was such a great guy.
Tim McClain.
Yeah, he was just real genuine, friendly. When I first started caving with them, Dave Everton invited me, kind of invited Tony and I for several years over and over. He'd see us at capers and go, oh, come on. Whatever kind of trip you want, Marion, I'll take you on any kind of trip you want, you know.
He's leading the Binkley Project.
Yeah, and so I kind of took him up on it. I think more because Danny and the group, they were doing a lot of digging. And I just didn't want to carry big bucket loads of rocks anymore. And I just needed cave. I needed survey. That's my thing. I love to survey.
Yeah.
So I took him up on it. I just met him once at their breakfast place. Didn't know anybody, really.
Really?
Didn't know anybody, no. But they were all such nice guys. I mean, Dave, Tim McClain, Rand Hazlett, Shane Miles, Tim Pride. They're all just wonderful guys. When I went caving there, I felt good.
Yeah.
I felt like, you know, they were going to watch out for me too and help me out. And true to Dave's word, I was like, oh, Dave, you know, I like caving. I like long trips. You know, this is what I like to do. I like long, hard trips. So he takes me on this long, hard trip.
It's like, you want a long, hard trip? I'll give you one.
And it was with Tim and all. And I don't know how long it was, 14 hours or whatever. And I think I come out with like 30 pounds of mud on me. I don't know how I did it.
That's basically
I don't know how
you.
I got out. You know, it was hard. It was, but I kept going, like one trip that year and then two trips the next year. And then, you know, we just started finding, we found some great cave from the Miller entrance. We ended up finding McLean River, which is a fantastic, long, big borehole ending in this huge mountain room, one of the biggest rooms in the cave. Fortunately, it takes like 6-7 hours to get back there. And then we found Dewey.
Yeah, Dewey Eckert Hole.
Oh, that was so great. Like, it's just a great cave. It ended up being like a mile and a half of cave that we connected into Binkley. That was fun. You know, and I've always loved Dewey. I mean, I'll go back to Dewey anytime, but we've got some things in there to push. We've got, you know, Wonder Bars laying around in there that we need to get out and stuff.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd like to do like a yearly through trip where we do, you know, some from the historic entrance and from the Dewey entrance and meet.
Do a crossover?
Yeah, do a crossover. Oh, we did it at Capers 1 year. We did it. And when Capers was down at the fairgrounds in Harrison County.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'd like to keep doing that. So
I'd love to go on one of those.
It's a really neat cave. So. And then since then, we've kind of been pushing little pits around Binkley.
This is to kind of expand the system
a little bit? Yeah, we're trying to, because we have done dye traces in the system that show a connection from inside, like the McLean area in that passage. You did a dye trace. And also a little closer to Miller entrance. And they ended up coming out at springs that are 5 miles one way from the cave. So we know they dye trace to this exit. So we've been trying to get into the cave another way. The digs are just, they're dangerous. They're hard. And we just haven't had the luck yet. And now we've got like, now the water, you know, it has to be super dry, you know.
Yeah.
And during this whole period, too, Dave slowly exited the project, being more involved in his band and, you know, for various reasons. So I have now the data and continue to build the line plot. And I've made little sections of maps. There's parts of Binkley are drafted. But not the whole thing, because 20 miles of it is pre-Dave.
Yeah.
Pre, you know, so it doesn't have vertical inclination, like 20 miles of it.
Yeah.
From the ISS and the BIG, they didn't have that. So it's not one big, huge file. So, but, you know, I'm trying to progress and turn it into something bigger.
Yeah.
And turn it into something that people can follow and understand the roots and the cave and... And so that's still going. That's still all going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, December.
It's 2016. So this was it. What was the objective on this trip?
Okay, it was close to Christmas, right?
Right.
So we were all desperate to go caving.
Let's get away from the family.
Yeah, it's like we got to go caving. And a couple of people were like, no, you know, it's so cold. It was bitter. It was freezing. It was below zero. It was nasty. It was supposed to snow a little bit. So a couple of people just didn't want to go because of that. We did have an objective. We were going to go back to the DMB crawl, which is a low, like, ear dripper crawl, and there was definitely survey beyond that.
Yeah.
And
you were in the crawl.
I was in the crawl. So we got to the crawl.
Yeah.
So a couple of us went through the crawl, and there were seven of us. And Rand and I went through in the crawl. Laura was back with Sarah, you know, and Sarah kind of looked at the crawl. And she was like, you know, I don't know if I should really do this. And no, so they kind of stayed back. Trey was about to come through. I'm not sure if Jesse had already come through or not. You know, we're back there and I don't remember how long it was. But we had voice connection between the two lowest points. And we noticed this waterfall on the side, and the water was kind of cloudy. You know, and Rand was like, you know, that water's cloudy. That's kind of weird, you know. And Trey calls back to us and he goes, man, I think the water's going up. And Rand and I looked at each other, and we were like, you know, he could be right. And we didn't know anything at that point.
No.
And it wasn't too high that, you know, we were beyond ear dipper or anything. So we all kind of got out of there. I kind of got caught a little bit, went a little bit of the wrong way, and ended up sputtering a little bit in water.
Mm.
So when I got out of there, I was kind of like a little, you know, breathing heavy, you know. It's like, okay, I got out of there. That was weird. I just went the wrong way. So we had tea, you know, as I like to make hot tea in the cave. And we ate and we hung out and relaxed a little bit. And we're like, okay, we feel better. Let's start heading out. So we head out.
And by this point, you see the water.
We're at a passage where we're kind of not in the full water passage at that point. We'd gotten out of that crawl.
Okay, you moved off to the side.
We got back out to an area close to Fantastic Avenue, and then we see the water. What was knee-deep was chest-high.
Oh.
And so, you know, we all kind of, your eyes got real big. We're like, oh, my God, you know, there must have been a rain event, you know. Oh, my goodness. But we still didn't really know what we were in for. You know, Rand gets in the water and he marks the wall really clearly where the level is. And, you know, we kind of all make a group decision. We're like, oh, good. You know, we're close to Fantastic Avenue. It's a relatively dry, kind of pretty passage with formations, and it does not flood.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, okay, well, we're right here. We're safe right here. Let's hang out up here. So we, you know, get up there in Fantastic Avenue, which is, you know, right there. 100 feet away, and we spread out, put our trash bags on, light candles, just hang out, eat a little bit. And, you know, I'm used to being in the cave, you know, but, you know, not everybody. Sarah hadn't been, that was her longest trip to date, hour-wise.
Yeah.
So I don't remember how long exactly we waited, but a number of hours we waited, and the water was going down. We saw it. We kept, you know, going out there and checking, the water's going down. I'm like, well, let's try it. And so Binkley is from the historic entrance. You can take this passage called Layman's Cutoff, and it kind of cuts off a big section of the big river trail.
Yeah.
And that's what we had done to go in. And we were like, well, let's go the big way. You know, it's bigger passage, not crawl, not, you know, we don't know if Layman's Cutoff, if that's flooded or not. We have no idea. So we decided to go back down the river passage. And going downstream, and the water is just getting deeper and deeper. And we reached this point, I think it was fairly close to the teardrop formation. But at this point, you know, I hadn't done a ton in the cave. So it was just Laura and Rand that really knew the cave, that had been there a bunch. And they were a little confused because the water was so high that everything looked different. You know, so at one point we were like almost chest high, you know, we're like, Rand's like, why don't you guys just wait here a minute? I'm going to go up ahead and see and see what's going on up ahead and see if it gets worse or better. So we wait there 15 minutes at least. And he comes back And you could tell, we could tell that it wasn't good. Mm. He had told, he come back, he was white, he was shaking, he was cold. He goes, I had to claw my way back. I almost got pulled downstream. He had to grab the wall, and it was so strong. The current was so strong. And he pulled his way back and got back to us. And, you know, Laura had done some rescue training. So I think that kind of was kicking in big time with her. And we looked at each other. You know, we hugged him. We tried to warm him up. At that point, we knew.
Yeah.
We knew. We knew we're in for something even bigger than what we thought. We didn't know at that point, before that, how bad the flood was. But at that point, we knew. So we were just like, okay, let's just go back. Let's just go back to Fantastic Avenue and just wait there and hang out. And it was like one thing at a time. Laura's like, we got one thing we can do right now, and that's what we can do. Because we were all, you know, we're like, well, what are we, you know, we were all thinking about how are we ever going to get out of here. And we fought our way upstream, warmed us all up, really. Mm-hmm. And we left flagging at big intersections where we could tell people where we were. Because at that point, we kind of like, well, we've been in here 20 hours. We knew that they knew. We knew they knew.
Somebody knew something was up.
Yeah, and we were all like, look, they're out on the surface. They're planning a rescue for us. We know they're out there. We were all saying that. We know they're out there looking for us. And so it turns out like 4.5 inches of rain had fallen in like less than 2 hours. Mm.
That wasn't forecasted at all.
Well, there was a 20%.
Yeah.
Okay, so that, at that, you know, they never balked at 20%,
no.
Really. But the problem was, is the ground was frozen solid and the water just sunk immediately. There was no, you know, in the summer right now, you know, it would soak into this dry, hot ground. Probably would never do that, even if it rained that much, you know. But at that point, everything was frozen solid. The water sunk immediately. Gary knew.
Yeah.
Gary Roberson knew that night. He goes, they're in trouble. I know it. He started calling people. He called Shane. You know, he called the guys that knew the cave, said, get ready. At 8 a.m., we're gonna start something.
Wow.
So the problem was, though, the water was so high, like the rescue group, when they all got there, like they sent Joe Kinder and Greg McNamara in to the mountain room to say, you know, let's see if they're at the mountain room. Let's see how high the water is. Let's see. So they went there, and the water was so high, they had a hard time getting back to the entrance.
They made it to the mountain room.
I think they made it to the mountain room. Didn't make it any further, but they come back out, and then at that point, it was a waiting game. And I think we were at least 24 hours in when our supplies were nearing nothing,
mm-hmm.
Very little water. We all realized we weren't drinking very much anymore. Trey had since pulled out his big summer sausage
that he had,
and that was great. But we were all kind of, you know, thinking, well, how long are we going to last here? You know, is everybody going to be able to get out when we can get out? And we knew we had to make a move at some point. And then during the end, those last couple hours, it was like we kept hearing things. Like we'd be sitting in the passage and we'd hear something and we'd all start hollering, you know, like, woo, you know, who, there's somebody out there, they're coming in. And then we'd stop and we realized there was nobody. We really, that happened like several times.
It was just the water playing tricks
something,
on you.
Yeah, it was playing tricks on us. And then at one point we kind of all got up from our little laying down hovel area and we're standing up trying to stay warm and we started talking and we were like, we need to make another attempt to get out. This time we were going to go through Layman's Cutoff. And so we had just started to gather our things. And then they showed up.
Oh.
Shane, Tim Pride, and Nick Benton, they showed up with some food and, you know, water. And then we got out.
Wow.
So it was like, yeah, it was like 39 hours total. I think I kind of like floated out. My eyes were probably closed half the way. You know, somebody's on each arm holding me up, and I'm just kind of, you know, on autopilot. And we got out.
Yeah.
We all got out safely. No one was hurt, you know. And but it was, it, what was weird for me was I was kind of alone, really. Tony was in Mexico. You know, I stayed at Rand's that night, but I was just everything. I didn't really understand what was going on with me, you know, because I was really upset. Even the next day, even after sleep and a meal, I was very upset. And
you were traumatized.
I was so traumatized. And I went home by myself. I don't know how I drove home. And then I was just miserable. I was sick. I had a bad sinus infection. I wasn't eating. My sister-in-laws came, and when they realized I wasn't eating, it was in bed. Simon didn't know what to do with me. And he was young. Yeah, you know, he wasn't that old. Yeah, you know, I mean, he was a teenager, but you know,
he
didn't know what to do with me. And they came and took me to the doctor, got me some medication. I was still messed up, and I didn't even realize why. You know, I was like, well, we're all okay, and nobody died, and we're safe. And I finally ended up reading some Facebook post by Anmar, and he explained it. And it wasn't in response to me or anything, but he explained what happens when all your hormones, and you're running on adrenaline, and, you know, the cave wasn't hard, right? I mean, I'm very used to caving, so even though, you know, that was a very long cave trip, you know, I got out, you know,
right.
It seemed seemingly normal, right? But he said everything disappears in your body, so you have nothing in there, no hormone, nothing, no endorphins, nothing.
Everything is being dedicated to survival.
Yeah. So then after that, you're totally, you know, drained.
Interesting.
So I was depressed for months.
Wow.
And I felt alone. It was awful. I had, you know, it was just like the most traumatic thing. I felt like I'd been ripped open and had to heal myself back and, you know, probably needed therapy or something, but.
How long did it take before you got back into a cave?
Well, then I went to Mexico.
And then you went straight to Mexico. The next month?
Yeah, kind of the next month. I was still messed up there. Both Rand and I were messed up.
Yeah.
Rand was going to Mexico with us already at that time. And then I understood it a little bit better, but I never really wanted to stop caving.
Yeah.
Well, you know? And we're actually going back there.
The same place, same area?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going back there.
Check the weather first.
Well, now we don't go in.
If there's any rain chance at all.
None.
No.
20%, none.
Yeah.
We just don't. We just can't take that chance because, you know, with the way storms are nowadays, it can drop a lot of rain. You don't know. There's no real predictor of what precipitation is going to be. And and the landowner is very friendly. He still allows us to go in. He actually prevented the media from coming onto the property, which the rescue groups are really happy about. Mm. So, yeah, so all in all, it was hard because it was so personal.
Yeah.
So it's like people wanted to talk about it. People wanted our stories. It was
you gotta
very,
let some time pass.
It was very hard for me to even share it. You know, it was so personal. So even when they did the rescue aftermath, I don't know what they call it, where they kind of analyze it all. I wasn't there, but they didn't need me there. But it just felt like a violation almost. That's how it all felt to me, just because it was so personal, affected me so much. So, but, you know, that's when you go out and you do things, and travel across the world, or you go into the caves, you're bound to have some experiences and hopefully you learn lessons and hopefully you get stronger. I don't know. I don't know if I really got stronger, but.
Well, you learned a few things.
I did.
And, well,
I
it's did. Fascinating to me that perspective that Anmar gave you about what your body does and the reason why you felt the way you did.
The physiological reason for my emotional state.
Yeah.
It all went back to
that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I'd never even considered that.
Yeah. So the after effect of something like that for me was much more difficult than the actual event.
Mm.
So.
Well, and that brings us to, I mean, that was 6 years ago. Well, it's coming up on 6 years ago now.
Jeez.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But so now you're doing this big project down in Fern.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was kind of a bombshell. So we like to go, in recent years, you know, the group, the Indiana guys and stuff, would like to do a tourist trip every now and then down in Tag, you know, like the Ellison's trip, through trip, just for fun, not any exploration project stuff. We did Rumbling Falls, which is great. So Joe Kinder had been talking about going to Fern. I think he had gone and done Surprise Pit or something. And I was like, wow, I'd love to go to Fern. You know, that's I went back there in the 90s with JV and had some great trips. I just love that cave. So we talked about it for a couple years, like, oh, let's plan a trip to Fern. You know, and Joe's like, well, I know Steve. And I was like, well, I know Steve, too, a little bit. And so Joe ended up setting up this trip November last year, and we did Surprise. Some of us did Surprise, and then the next day we went in the Johnson entrance, and Steve took us on a trip. And so it was just this great kind of reconnection, and Steve and I talked, and you know, JV was his best friend, and he took over being liaison to the Fish and Wildlife Service when JV died. He took that over. You know, it's also Surprise is also SECI property. You know, so there's several entities there that are involved. And Steve realized, you know, gosh, I've got a cartographer. I've got an exploration team. I've got, you know, I've got this group here.
Mop up some of this data.
And him and Jennifer Pinkley, you know, had worked really, really hard to get Fern open back up after WNS. And it's still a limited basis. It's not like it was, you know, when JV was doing it, you know, you could take trips in there as long as, you know, it was fielded, who could go, who knew the cave and all that. But you could take trips. And they worked it pretty hard so they could open the cave back up. And for the Fuse Fish and Wildlife Service, they like the map. They like the survey. They like the idea of knowing what that cave is 100%. So Steve and Jennifer got it open back up, you know, to limited trips. And then when he offered it to us, hey, how would you guys like to continue the survey project? I was like, oh, my God, you know, how could I turn that down? I mean, you know, project of a lifetime for me and something I've never done before, that big of a cave. So I consulted Pat again, and she had actually helped set up some of the initial data handling of the project. And, you know, wasn't involved with it at the time or anything, but I was like, you know, do you think you could help me start this so I can make this map? She goes, well, you're going to have to make quads. You know, you have to separate it out. It's like, well, I've never done that before, but okay, you know. And so I'm working with her again and working with Steve. You know, we're relearning the cave. We're learning all the sections of the cave again. We're doing survey trips. We have almost reached 10 miles surveyed horizontal passage. We're close to that.
Wow.
Next trip, I'm hoping we reach, you know, and there's about 16 miles that's known. So we still got a ways to go.
Multiple frontiers of where it could go?
Well, we've got, you know, what Trode already did.
Right.
So he went to many, many areas in the cave, many exposed areas too, without rope.
Oh.
I mean, he was the one they named the Trojan, where he actually dug out the ledge up above Surprise, so you could get over there to do it. He dug that ledge out.
Without a rope?
Did so much without a rope.
Oh, my God.
And I mean, some of these climbers, they just run on this stuff, and we're like, well, we need rope. we need traverse
we
lines.
Need protection of some kind.
Yeah,
anything.
Yeah. So we're actually helping, you know, rig certain parts of the cave, replace old ropes. We're doing a lot of stuff in the cave, and I've just had so much fun learning the cave again through going and surveying and through studying the data and stuff. So all that's coming around. I hope to start making drafts once we really get the quads set up, and we're going to do profile quads, which from Pat's saying nobody's ever done profile quads.
So explain to me what that is.
Okay,
that
so like plan view quads would be, you know, the cave broken up into pieces because it's really big,
right?
And the plan view shown on a map.
Yeah.
You know, in sections. Mm-hmm. But we're going to actually do the profile view as well.
Okay. Because there's multiple levels.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tarode said there were 21 levels. Pat has really identified 7 firm separate levels. But okay. Yeah, it's very vertical.
So this is she's basing that on her definition of it, or perhaps, I mean,
studying the line plot and looking at the different elevations and the different levels in the cave.
And she's pretty much, I mean, when I think of Pat Cambyses, I think, you know, she's the standard. So as far as her standard goes, 7 levels.
Yeah, that's what she says. And and looking at it via elevation, the line plot. So, yeah, so that's super exciting and kind of a really huge in my development, you know, because my longest cave map is probably 9,000 feet or, you know, a good bit of vertical. I've done a lot of vertical stuff, but yeah, nothing that big.
Yeah.
So it's it's pretty exciting. And we're still doing Binkley stuff. It's harder to get to the frontiers and the digs outside of the main Binkley cave, those are hard because they're demanding.
Yeah.
You know, they take a lot of work and effort. And so, but we're not done there. It's not over.
we barely got into maps either.
I know.
In this talk.
So, yeah, because that's survey is kind of my focus.
Yeah.
I've just recently in the last 2 years finished 100 maps total, which half of them being Mexico maps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but I've finished everything that I've sketched.
Your maps are gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. I work hard on them. And
they really, I mean, there's detail. They all seem sort of standard. When would you say you fell into the sort of standard that you have now with maps, as far as the details, the legend, everything that you've got going?
I mean,
because it takes a while to develop to get to that point.
It does, but I kind of, I think my style really started early on.
Really? Okay.
I think it really did. Looking at some of my earliest notes, I've had a similar style.
Because you gotta put those limits on it. You gotta make those rules because you can get lost in details.
You can. You really can. Now I'm trying to do a little more 3D approach in my profile views. You know, my goal is to represent the cave, but not get lost in the detail. So somebody can follow the map through all different levels, even if they're on top of each other, mm-hmm. and get to the bottom. That's my goal.
Yeah.
So the caving, you know, cartography has changed considerably since I've started doing it. I mean, like I said, I was doing it on Mylar. Mm-hmm. And then when I started making maps again, I think it was like Simon was like 5 or 6. So I had probably taken like a 5-7 year hiatus in my cartography. And I started doing that again. I was like, well, I'm going to start my maps again. So I started the same way, Mylar. I took my Mylar to the printer. And all of a sudden I realized there was no longer a beautiful photographic printer anymore that you could get a nice, beautiful master copy that you'd make copies off of. They didn't have that anymore.
Yeah. No.
So then I went to Pat. It's like, what am I supposed to do here?
What are you doing?
I don't have a good copy anymore. What's, you know, she's like, well, you got to do it by computer. You know,
what are you using?
In my generation, I learned how to use the computer. I was forced to in mm-hmm. college. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, like in the late 80s, I had to use Microsoft Word in the computer, the one computer lab at Georgia Tech. I was forced to. I didn't want to, you know. So I had to learn Illustrator. She taught me Compass. She taught me basics in Illustrator.
You use an Illustrator,
I use Illustrator.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, everything has gotten a lot more technical. So there's some just magnificent cartographers out there that are just doing amazing stuff where I think my style, even though I've grown and developed a lot, is somewhat stable.
Well, that's consistency is important, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but I'm not as technical as some of these folks, some of these younger folks, you know, super technical. So I I'm still learning new program. I look at it as like a learning in progress. You never stop progressing in sketching, mm-hmm. in survey, in cartography. You keep learning and developing from the last one. Mm. So I'm really excited, you know, and I'm still going. I mean, I'm in my mid-50s now, so recovery's a bit harder on the long trips.
Takes a few more days.
So I got to stay in shape, you know, so I can keep doing all this stuff.
And the only way you can stay in caving shape is to go caving.
Basically.
There's nothing else you can do.
Yeah, I mean, you can try and work out and exercise.
That doesn't help with caving.
No, because after a big, long trip, you know, every muscle hurts, everything's sore.
Because you never use those muscles.
Yeah, you're not using every single, you know, muscle that you'd use in caving. So, yeah. But I'm still going. So that's as long as I can go, I'm going to keep, you know, going for it. You know,
I'd love to go with you sometime.
All right,
let's go.
Right.
I hope we end up on a trip together sometime.
All right.
I still kick myself for not having gotten involved with the Binkley Project when I had time. Now that I'm a dad, I don't have any time.
Yeah.
You've
only got one, right?
I got two.
Oh, you got two boys. That's hard because I had Simon and I thought, gosh, if I had two,
yeah,
I it would have been harder, but we stuck with it.
The one's five now, by the time people hear this, the other one will be three. And so I got a few more years, a couple more years before, like, I can, you know, really get out of the house.
Yeah, because they take, a lot of time and energy, and you want to share all those things with them, too.
Oh, yeah. It's the best part of my life, to be sure. But I definitely miss caving as often as I did.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely – you let me know when you're interested, and we'll go.
I got to get into Binkley.
We'll get you in there. Just got to be prepared for the mud.
Mud I can handle. I've been caving in Indiana for a while, so mud I'm used to. I could do it. Okay, so this is the portion of the interview where we caught back up with Marion. Marion, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Matt?
I'm so wonderful. It was so good to hang out. I mean, when we recorded the interview before, it was pre-Capers, and I had such a great time with you at Capers and everybody else. I really appreciated chatting and everything that we talked about at Capers was wonderful.
I know. I'm so glad that you got to see Thomas.
Oh yeah.
Face to face. He's a wonderful guy. And then you also, when we were all at camp, you know, an hour later, you discovered you had another podcast, Carol Vesley. You had her, she was sitting there the whole time and you didn't realize it.
So
that was fun.
To run into caving, to stumble upon caving royalty like that was just, that was an unbelievable highlight of the weekend. It was great.
Well, you're kind of becoming caving royalty, believe it or not.
Well, so. certainly not through actual caving, but to hear that coming from you, is unbelievable. And also, I consider Rand caving royalty too, and I got to go caving with him and Thomas on that Saturday, and we're kind of reconvening to share a little bit more about your caving life with Rand, right?
Yes, I wanted to share one of the stories that when I first actually surveyed, my first survey trip with Rand. I rediscovered that and thought, well, I really need to tell this story. This was in 2013, which was a pretty big year for Binkley Exploration. The previous years, they had discovered Blowing Hall, went all the way, you know, through the Indiana Caverns area. They had discovered a passage called the Miller High Line. I don't know if they'd actually named it that at the time, but in 2013, they started pushing Miller Cave, which they knew from the line plot was really close to it. So Miller Cave had been known about since like 1960. Norm Pace actually did the first survey of that, and there's some interesting history there. It's not the greatest cave. It's basically a crawl in gravel, a little bit of walking passage, but only, you know, maybe I think about 800 to 1,000 feet of cave there. And in the early part of 2013, when they started really, really pushing Miller, this little dig area, little squirrely area, of course, where you make a connection in, Tim was actually the one who was out front when they dropped into Miller High Life. And the rumor is he had a piece of webbing with him and a Wonder Bar. And he basically used that to drop like 10 feet down into the Miller High Life passage, which was part of the blowing hole. So, and then they somehow got him back up through that hole where there's now a 9-foot ladder right there where you drop into the cave. Rand actually, when they started pushing this area even further in June of 2013, they had come upon Rand's return river ride, which as you're looking at it, it's a low water crawl, you know, fully body submerged, maybe a helmet, head, sometimes maybe an ear dipper, but mostly, you've got your head above water and you're going through it. Well, he pushed this thing. It's about 900 feet of this.
Wow.
So pretty monumental that he pushed it and got through. So in July, we went back, and this trip we were with Dave Everton, Tim McLean, and Laura Demarest. And we did a leapfrog survey through this section of cave. So Rand, I remember one point we were kind of in the middle of it and he stopped. And I caught up to him, you know, my sketchbook is in the air, you know, I'm trying to keep it dry. And he's like, look, you know, this is probably about the worst that survey gets in here. So if you can do this, you can do just about anything. So we laughed about that and had a real good time and got through it and got to this famous junction where there's pictures circulated about this junction. There's a famous one with Tim and Laura and Rand. And I just took one recently with Nick Anderson and Rand. And that trip was pretty memorable. We ended up continuing survey that day. And Dave went one direction and I went the other. And I remember him coming up to me a little bit later in the trip. And he's like, well, I think I've ended my survey back there. You know, how about you guys? You know, and I remember looking up and I had this glazed look in my eyes, you know, and I realized right then, well, I'm done. You know, I can't really do any more survey. So that area, you know, led to the discovery of McLean River. It's got big passage, the Milky Way, the Wild Wild West, the Wilson Way, you know, about over 5 miles of cave back there. So that was pretty, you know, monumental discovery and to be part of that survey. And then also to be with Rand, who, you know, is one of my best friends. And we've continued surveying, you know, ever since then. Great trip to look back on. And I thought it really, you know, was worth mentioning.
Absolutely it is. I mean, the amount of work that you guys have done in Indiana's longest cave, Binkley, is it's kind of staggering when you're as close to it as, when you're close to it in the way that I am and that I just kind of read about it and don't actually go and do it, just the amount of mileage that's been added to that cave just in the last 10 or 12 years is really, really amazing.
25 miles about with, you know, Dave's bar being very productive. And then we've managed to, you know, add some more to the cave, and it's getting harder to find and to get to the rear areas. So we hope that we can change that.
Can you then sort of illustrate what it takes to get to that area now as we know it, and kind of then that'll explain why you're looking for another entrance. Like, this is a good bit of travel time to just get to this spot.
It's it's a solid, I don't know, it's a solid 7-8 hours.
Wow.
Depending on your speed. And like I said, Miller all the way through the Rand's Return River Ride is a lot of crawling. So I don't know, more than a mile.
Wow.
And then once you're past that, you're in a good bit of walking passage, but it's stream passage, water filled, a lot of suck mud. Takes a lot of energy to get back there. Just after Rand's Return River Ride, that's only about a third of the way in, maybe. And that takes 2 to 3 hours just to get there. So by the time you get back there, 7 to 8 hours, it's hard to really get a lot of energy going to do more survey. And plus, you know, with weather concerns and things, it's, you know, we talked about trying to camp back there, but, you know, it's just really, really challenging.
Knowing what you know about the overlay and everything, this potential new entrance, how much time do you think it could shave off of that travel?
Oh, my God. I mean, you'd be in there in a half hour.
That's a big difference.
And with the technology and, you know, and some people really willing to put a lot in there, a lot to do that, you know, money included. And then, of course, you've got landowner concerns, you know, we've got to deal with that and hope that they're amenable to it. And so there's a lot of steps there, but they've done it before.
Yeah.
You know, they did it with Indiana Caverns, with Deep Darkness, and they've done a variety of radiolocation trips that were successful. So
let's stay in Binkley and
Okay.
Yeah, well, and talk about, well, it wasn't always Binkley, but it is now known as Binkley Dewey Eckert Hole. I mean, you did a lot in there we didn't get to talk about yet.
Yeah, we really did. There were, you know, a little bit of history there with the discovery of Dewey Eckert Hole and a variety of different trips. You know, after about 5-6 solid dig trips, you know, we got into there and with a lot of passage improvement, got to an area in the cave where we didn't have to dig anymore. So what a great, you know, caving experience to be able to go in and just survey until you can't and then leave and come back and do it again. So a lot of great trips in there. I wanted to mention one trip that we did in July of 2016. We had gotten to an area that nice passage, fairly walking, and it ended in this, we could see out into a room, but we couldn't get down it. A big slope, a kind of a drop off, and, you know, kind of dangerous to get around. And unknowingly, you know, we were very excited about this. We called it the Apocalypse Abyss and didn't turn out quite to be as apocalyptic as we thought. But it took us like 3 times to get past this. And the third time, I actually had Tony Akers rig a traverse line around the left side of it. So this one little step across that was maybe about 20, 30 feet deep, you know, we were able to safely pass, you know, with the hand line right there. And again, it just kind of turned out to be a big section of the cave, you know, a big room, pretty, but not as big as we might have hoped. And it just, the passes just continued. So this trip in July, we got past it and we were excited, got into a great dry passage, some really pretty gypsum crystals, and ended up in another room. We ended up calling it Mary's Room. Greg McNamara, one of our best friends, his mother had passed recently and decided to name this room after her. So we get to this room and it seemingly ended, you know, and there were a couple leads there, a down climb area that looked promising. And across the room, you know, they started digging furiously with their wonder bars and it was very pretty, had even a waterfall area and black shale shelf there, which typically can indicate, you know, another layer. And so we worked this thing, I don't know, for over an hour and didn't find any way on. And then all of a sudden, like, Rand goes back out of the room, back towards where we came, and finds a little hole on the left-hand side and just said, you know, hey, has anybody looked in this? And of course, nobody had. So he jumps in there, and it's pretty low. It's really dry. I think him and Shane might have had to dig just a little bit. But it turned out to be what we call a flypaper crawl, about 150 feet or so. And it turned out to be the passage that ultimately connected to the Foggy Mountain breakdown room in Binkley.
So Dewey Eckert became Binkley.
Not that trip, but yeah, the next trip where we had the connection trail, that's when we were able to connect in. And we couldn't really dig from the Dewey side because we would have had to dig up into the breakdown, which is pretty dangerous. You know, that's the most dangerous type of digging. You're trying to dislodge breakdown that's above you. But from the line plot, we knew that it was really close to the Foggy Mountain breakdown. And the next trip that we planned, once the group reached the Foggy Mountain room, the group made a voice connection pretty quick, and they were able to dig through in, I don't know, a couple hours and make that connection. So that's kind of rare too. And that was a fun one.
How exciting. So,
yeah. And Dewey, you know, Dewey still has some leads in there, and I will always go back in there. But there's, you know, we've kind of not really worked many of the leads in there anymore. And so maybe one day, next generation.
Wow. It's got to be cool when you realize that it's going to happen, connecting the two. Does all of the work and all of the time that you'd put in just that day kind of just dissolve, and the excitement takes over and time just flies by, and before you know it, you've been in the cave, gosh, you know, 10, 15 hours or something like that?
Well, it's really, really a good feeling when you make a connection like that. And I think with Binkley too, as probably as a lot of different caves, just the history there is fascinating to me, because like in Binkley, that area, the Millennium Passage that leads to the Foggy Mountain Breakdown Room, they worked that in the 90s with the dog still, got Terry Creighton.
Yeah.
And had 20 some trips through this nasty little breakdown passage. So, you know, they broke into the Millennium Passage, which goes further than the Foggy Mountain Breakdown Room. But just the history and the amount of effort made by cavers of different generations, that's what is kind of, you know, really, really fascinating. And to be a part of that, to know all the work that was done by cavers before you, that's really, really neat for me.
And they must take comfort in the fact that it's continuing to be explored and that, you know, more mileage is being added all the time. And I mean, you can put your name on a number of discoveries in Binkley, right? Is there another one you want to share about?
Well, I do want to share about one from 2019. And this is actually a passage that I discovered, which you might think I've discovered a lot of passage, okay, but I haven't. I've more been a follower. You know, the sketcher with the survey book that follows behind, the caver that follows the group of guys like, you know, Danny and Tony and Ron and Greg, and they find stuff. You know, Ron finds stuff on ridge walks. I never find anything. I'm just the caver that comes after, right? You know, and it's great to be part of the initial group. You know, I feel like I'm part of that initial group, but still, there's not that many instances that I've really found a lot of new caves. So this trip that I'm going to talk about is in Binkley itself, not in Dewey. And we started going back to this area in 2019. And this area is now called the Crumble Way. And it's, if you know the Binkley Historic Entrance and you know where the Mountain Room is, it's actually just after the big break and before the Mountain Room. The first part of the passage is called Nichols Passage. And this was originally surveyed by the BIG, Robert Nichol, Jim Langhammer, and Mac Brown in 1959. So they went to this. Yeah. So I just love reading about this history. So Nichols Passage was the first part of it. And then later, 1970, Terry Craden, the dog, and others went back there and surveyed, got some more passage in. At this point, they're calling, they're the ISS, not the BIG. And then in 2000, Gary Roberson, his nickname's Hergar, and also the dog, went back with Rand in 2000. And so Rand, at this point, they're calling him the boy because he started caving. He started caving with them when he was 15 years old. So his nickname was the boy. So there was still some leads left back in there. And the dog was like, sure, that there was a pit back there that led into other passage. So 2019, we started going back there. And it's kind of a complex area. Some a little hard to get to, some exposure, climb ups, a couple different levels. And we did a couple survey trips back in there. And there's one trip at the end of November of 2019, and it was just Rand, Shane Miles, and me back there. And we had done some survey in the upper levels of the Crumble Way. And we were back down in kind of this main room that, I don't know if you call it a canyon. It was maybe, 15, 20 feet wide, 20 feet high, and kind of a long section. And at the very end of it, there's the classic BIG 15 in carbide, and then another station right there, ISS 1. Right there at this point at the end, on the big piles of breakdown. And we're kind of getting ready to leave, and we're looking around saying, what else is right here? And we found a low crawl that was kind of really muddy and nasty. And it ended up, we went there later, and Tony actually found dropped a pit that led back into the Mountain Room. So that was cool. But another area, I was like, well, I'm going to go down this slope right here and see if there's anything down here at the bottom. And so I go down there and I slip past these rocks. No real effort. It was a little narrow, but I got past and I kind of kept going. And I was walking and going around. And I was like, I thought at that point, I thought this was known passage. It looked like it was open and everything. So I figured it was known. And I come back and I said, Rand, well, here's some passage down here. And he goes, no, there's not. And I was like, yes, there is. And so we go down there and they're all shocked and surprised. We went maybe 100 to 200 feet or something. And they're all excited going, this is brand new. This has never been seen. And we get kind of to the end, or that we thought was the end, and it was this kind of big jumble of rocks with a little hole, and it was all covered in bat varnish. So have you ever seen what bat varnish looks like?
I guess not.
It's kind of this shiny brown covering, kind of. And if you see it, it was all throughout Dewey. But, once you start traveling in it, you kind of muddy it up. And you don't see it as much. Well, this had, big rocks and all this bat varnish leading down this hole. So we were really excited. But at that point, it was the end of the trip. and that was kind of going to be a dig, you know, like normal, right?
Yeah.
And so we left, and we ended up going back not too far from that. And we got, you know, surveyed to that point and took a break and ate. And was like, okay, you know, I'm kind of like gearing up for the dig, going, oh gosh, you know, how long is this going to take? And we didn't want to damage this pretty bat varnish rock area. Turned out in like less than 15 minutes, we got through with barely any damage to these rocks. And it ended up, you know, not a ton of passage, you know, 1,200, 1,300 feet. Beautiful walking passage, kind of interspersed with little flowstone pools. Because of a drippy areas. And just when I was getting tired and thinking that it would never end, of course it did, but that was a pretty fun discovery. And we ended up calling it Stumbleway.
Because you stumbled upon it?
I stumbled right on it, kind of matched the Crumbleway. And so that was a neat find. You know, I just want to say, like, give a little final message to your listeners and those who are listening to me. You know, we always in life, work, personal, and even in caving, we have to deal with politics, right?
Yeah.
Always politics. And it's just
a necessary
dealing with
evil.
People. Yeah. Just dealing with people. And for me, sometimes, if some of those things get sticky or I don't really understand what's going on, you know, me having kind of a German background, sometimes I can't really get a sense of things like other people can. So sometimes the cave politics are really hard. And so whenever I get confused, not really sure how to go forward, or I end up ruminating on something, the thing that I focus on most of all is action. Action always tells the story. Action speaks louder than words. And whenever people are just talking, all you got to do is act and make things happen. Keep caving, keep focusing on caving and what your goal is. And maybe you'll still be confused by the end of it, but that is the most important thing to focus on.
I think it's a great parallel because once you're in the cave, they can't find you to argue with you anyway, right?
That's right. That's right. It can be all about talk. Unless you're caving, unless you're walking the talk, then none of that matters. And yeah. So that's what I focus on with my projects and surveying and the things that happen with politics is just keep caving.
Yeah.
Don't let it stop you. Don't let your focus be taken away from unnecessary stuff. Keep caving, and that'll end up taking care of it.
Gosh, what terrific insight, because you're absolutely right. I mean, politics are sort of there on paper to be the establishment of parameters in one form or another in order to move things forward. But when it comes to the actual moving forward, it really gets in the way. So it's not to move things forward. It's to move things forward in one or two people's purview. You know what I mean? Actually moving forward the way you're talking is far more progressive. Progressive is in actual progress, not like, you know, liberal versus conservative, but actually progressive.
Yeah, actually doing something and making things happen. And for us, it's caving.
Yeah.
For us, it's surveying, it's exploration. That's what keeps me going. And sometimes I have to refocus and say, this is what's important. It's our actual work and our actual trips that are important. And being together, you know, for me, it's my friends, you know, making the lime pot grow and making the map. Those are, you know, the biggest things for me. Well, I'm hoping that I can talk with you again in another 10 years, Matt.
Yeah, we'll have a lot to catch up on.
Progress.
Exactly. What a pleasure.
It's been It's very much a pleasure. I really enjoy talking with you. You really make it easy. And just listening to all the other podcasts just made it so easy for me to say, hey, I have some stories to tell. And I love caving. And this is a huge, huge part of my life. And I wanted to share it. So thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Marian, I could do a 5-parter on you. We'll come back and do it again sometime.
All right. Sounds great, Matt. You take care, and hopefully I get to see you in a cave again at some point.
Oh my goodness, I hope so. I hope so, Marian. Thank you so much, and thank you for listening. This is a monthly podcast. I'll be back on November the 1st, and this time it will be with tag caver Fenn Spencer. You know Fenn. Or maybe you do. I see him post all the time. Fenn was a delight to talk to. And I've also got a few other irons in the fire. Thank you to everybody who has suggested cavers to talk to. And I've followed up with most of them, I think. Some of them have stalled, and that's okay. We'll reconvene. If you're one of them, reach back out to me. I'm very bad at organizing my emails, my personal emails. I kind of got to focus all that attention on my work emails and things like that. You know how it goes. But I want to talk to everybody. Anybody who wants to talk, I want to talk. And thanks to our sponsor, Sophie Reaptress. Visit sophiereaptress.com. Thanks to our past sponsor, Swego, swegogear.com. Get one of those nice shiny packs. Also, Organic Robot on Etsy. If your grotto wants to make t-shirts, Charlie's your guy. Or organicrobotdesigns.com. And also El Spelio, which I believe is now being sold by On Rope One. Okay, I think that's everything. You have a great month. Enjoy Tagfall Cave-In if you get to go. And until next time, kill nothing but time.